From the JAMA Network, this is JAMA Clinical Reviews, interviews and ideas about innovations in medicine, science, and clinical practice. Here's your host.
Hello, I'm Dr. Preethi Malani, Deputy Editor at JAMA and Professor of Medicine at the University of Michigan. Today, I'm joined by my friend and colleague, Dr. Rajesh Gandhi. Dr. Gandhi is a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and Director of HIV Clinical Services and Education at Massachusetts General Hospital and Director of the Harvard Center for AIDS Research. He is the lead author of the updated 2022 Antiretroviral Drugs for Treatment and Prevention of HIV Infection in Adults, which was published online first in JAMA on December 1st, 2022. Raj, welcome.
Great to be here.
So we were very intentional in selecting December 1st as the publication date for the updated treatment guidelines as a way to mark World AIDS Day. Clinicians who don't spend a lot of time caring for patients living with HIV may not realize just how much progress has been made in terms of treatment. To reflect for a minute, when I was a medical student, more than 30 years ago, we had only two drugs, AZT and DDI. Neither worked very well, and any perceived benefit was not durable. By the mid-1990s, protease inhibitors became available, and the idea of highly active treatment cocktails emerged. Fast forward 25 years, we now have multiple newer and better classes of antiretrovirals, not just more effective in terms of viral suppression, but much better tolerated and easier to take. And in fact, today, regimens of one pill once a day are used routinely, things that were unimaginable when you and I were ID fellows, which wasn't that long ago. The other thing that has changed is when to start treatment. Today, treatment is recommended regardless of CD4 count, and treatment should be started as soon as possible after diagnosis. So Raj, let's talk about some of the practicalities of when to start treatment for HIV. How do you think about this clinically?
So thank you for that question. And as you said, things have really changed dramatically in less than one career. And it's just been exciting to see how much dynamism there's been in the field of HIV. So prior to 2015, there was really an intense debate that went on as to when to start antiretroviral therapy. There was a camp that said, treat as quickly as you can. But then there was an equally large camp that said, wait until the CD4 count drops. Wait until it drops below 350. Wait until it drops below 200. And what was fueling that debate in the early 2010s was the recognition in the late 1990s that people on antiretroviral therapy have what's called a long-lived latent reservoir. What that means essentially is that HIV medications control the virus, but they don't eradicate the virus. And to this day, we still don't have a feasible cure for HIV. So there was a recognition that treatment needed to be for a lifetime. That was a sobering recognition in the late 1990s. You mentioned some of the drugs we used to use back then, drugs like AZT, DDI. These drugs had limited effectiveness when used in isolation, and when used in combination, they worked, but they came with a lot of toxicity. So back before 2015, there was a legitimate debate as to when to start antiretroviral therapy, again, early versus late. What really changed it almost overnight, was a study called the START study. And this was a randomized study that showed that people with HIV who received early antiretroviral therapy before their CD4 count had gone down did better than those who waited until the CD4 count fell. And that led to what's now called the treat-all approach. What that means is treat all people with HIV regardless of their CD4 count. And that was a dramatic change in our practice informed by a randomized clinical trial. Now, starting in 2015, that has really even extended to one other really important concept, which is treat as soon as possible after someone is diagnosed. So treat as soon as you can, including on the same day, a so-called test and treat approach. And so that has really been our current practice, is to treat early and treat as soon as the patient is ready and all the ducks are lined up in a row in terms of getting them started on treatment. No more delays.
In terms of specific antiviral agents, how do you decide what regimen to use for a particular patient?
So as you said, when I think you and I both started out, people were taking 18 to 24 pills a day, and they came with enormous amounts of toxicity. And that has changed really in a mind-blowing way. It's now almost everyone I care for is on one pill once a day. Usually people are taking what's called an integrase strand transfer inhibitor. Instead, integrase strand transfer inhibitors are the bedrock of our combinations. And we usually combine them, and our guidelines recommend that that integrase strand transfer inhibitor be combined with a drug called tenofovir and either FTC or 3TC. So most of my patients are on three drugs once a day, given as a single pill. Now, one recent change in the last few years, and our guidelines reflect this, is there are instances where you can use just two drugs. And that's a difference compared to a few years ago where we always gave three drugs. And the combination of dolutegravir with 3TC, which is a two-drug combination, has become one of our guideline-recommended combinations. Now, what are the considerations? How do I choose which drugs to use? Some of it depends on things like patient's kidney disease or whether they have kidney disease, if they have bone disease. Those are two reasons that I would sometimes choose a different regimen than if their kidney function is normal and they don't have any bone disease. I also consider whether they have hepatitis B. About 10% of patients are hep B co-infected, 5 to 10%. And in that instance, you want to use two drugs that work both against hep B and then two to three drugs that work against HIV. And then the last consideration is drug-drug interactions. The reason why integrase inhibitors are so popular now is because they have fewer drug-drug interactions than protease inhibitors in some of our older medicines. So we have more flexibility, but still there are some important drug interactions. Another consideration is the viral load and the CD4 count. The two drug therapies that I've recommended before, we tend to avoid if the viral load is very, very high or if the CD4 count is very, very low, in part because we just don't have that much information on two drug therapy when people are at the extremes of viral load or CD4 count. And finally, resistance. Resistance testing is still recommended by our guidelines panel. There is some cases where people have transmitted drug resistance, and do we take that into account? I think the last thing I'll say is something that's been one of the biggest advances in recent years. You and I have just been talking about oral therapies, one pill once a day, but now, really for the first time starting just over a year ago, is the option of giving injectable antiretroviral therapies. So what is that all about? For people whose viral load is suppressed, their HIV is under control on oral daily therapy, we now have the option of using an injectable combination of a drug called cabotegravir with a second drug called rilpivirine. And this injection can be given every 2 months. So instead of people taking even a pill every day, now they're just taking their medicine 6 times a year. And so that has been another major advance. It's not for everyone, but for those people who have difficulty remembering to take a pill every day or just don't want that constant reminder that they have HIV, by taking a pill every day, we now have the option of offering them every 2 month injectable antiretrovirals.
So side effects and adverse effects have been a major barrier to treatment. And today's medications, as you note, are better tolerated. What are some of the common issues or complications that occur related to the currently available therapies?
So things have gotten better. Again, back when I started with those handful of pills, two handfuls of pills that people were taking, there were a lot of GI side effects, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, fatigue and headache were notorious with drugs like AZT, and those have largely gone away. Most of our combinations now don't have anywhere near the amount of side effects as those older combinations. Two interesting side effects that have come to the fore that we spend a lot of time counseling patients about and considering. One is a weight gain. Turns out that when you start antiretrovirals, regardless of what drug you start, many, many people will gain some weight, and that's sometimes good. We know that patients who've lost weight because of their HIV, that weight gain reflects what's called a return to health. They're actually, as their virus comes under control, their metabolism goes back to normal. And so weight gain is common. But what we've learned in the last 5 years is some of our antiretrovirals are linked to what's called excessive weight gain. Excessive weight gain is usually defined as gaining more than 10% of your ideal body weight. And that occurs in about 10% of patients. It's more common in women, and it's more common in African-American and Hispanic patients. And for people who have excess weight gain, that is an important side effect that we're still working on trying to figure out how to ameliorate, how do we make it better. Another side effect that we pay a lot of attention to are metabolic complications. We want to make sure patients who are now anticipated to live a normal lifespan, we want to make sure that their cardiovascular disease risk is as low as possible, that they have normal cholesterols, that if they need a statin, that we prescribe a statin. And so those are some of the considerations that really inform our thinking about side effects, those types of issues.
To reiterate, with treatment today, many people with HIV can expect a normal lifespan. In other words, you have lots of older adults who've been living with HIV for years and in some cases decades. What are some of the key concerns that you're thinking about with patients in their 60s, their 70s, and beyond?
More than half of my patients are over the age of 50, and almost a quarter of them are over the age of 60. So it's really very, very common. And with aging, of course, comes a variety of other, what we call comorbidities, other conditions that people have related to their age. So I was touching on bone and heart health. I think those are two considerations that are becoming more and more important. Osteoporosis is common in people with HIV, trying to choose drugs that are less likely to exacerbate osteoporosis. Heart disease is very common in people with HIV, probably linked to some amount of what's called residual immune activation, residual inflammation. And so we do pay a lot of attention to trying to make sure people who have an elevated cardiovascular risk score are on a statin. Some of the other considerations that I think we give a lot of attention to is polypharmacy. We said that earlier on, the integrase inhibitors are less likely to have drug interactions, but nevertheless, as people are on 2, 3, 4, 5 medications, we want to make sure that there's not drug-drug interaction. And then I will say cognitive problems, again, linked to aging, but also linked to HIV. And I would say that's another area that we need more progress in terms of how we can best manage and really assure a good quality of life for patients.
In the updated guidelines, the writing group highlighted some of the new challenges that have emerged in the last couple of years, including monkeypox and COVID-19. What role does HIV infection play in terms of the clinical management of monkeypox and COVID-19?
So let me start with COVID-19. From its very earliest weeks, there was a discussion as to whether people with HIV would be more likely to have severe COVID-19. And why were we worried about that? Well, we knew from influenza that people with advanced HIV, usually defined as a CD4 count less than 200 or not being on therapy, we knew that people with advanced HIV, uncontrolled HIV, had more severe influenza outcomes. So we were worried that maybe the same thing would happen with COVID-19. I will say during the first few months of COVID, some of the early studies did not really show much of an effect of HIV on COVID. So some studies out of New York City, it seemed that people with HIV were having similar outcomes as to people without HIV. However, as we've gotten more and more data over the last 2.5 years or so, it's pretty clear that there is an impact of HIV on COVID. What I mean by that is people with HIV do have somewhat more severe COVID outcomes, but it is largely in that high-risk population. It's largely in people who are either not on treatment or who have low CD4 counts. And so we have learned a lot about how HIV and COVID interact. One bit of data that was recently published in the JAMA journals is a recognition that people with HIV who have gotten vaccinated for COVID have a higher rate of COVID breakthrough, that is acquiring COVID even though they've been vaccinated, than people without HIV. And most importantly, if the CD4 count is low, below 200 to 350, they have a higher rate of severe COVID. So what does that tell me? It tells me that I need to make sure my patients are vaccinated, but also boosted. And if they do acquire COVID, which many people do still, of course, they get tested and they get offered treatment. Now, the most commonly given treatment throughout the United States is nirmatrelvir-ritonavir. Ritonavir is a drug that used to be used quite a bit in HIV. It's being used with nirmatrelvir to boost the levels. Nirmatrelvir-ritonavir goes by the trade name of Paxlovid. One thing that was questioned is, can you give nirmatrelvir-ritonavir to someone with HIV? And the answer is yes, you really can. And you don't really need to worry about stopping any of their other medications because it's such a short duration of nirmatrelvir-ritonavir. So those 5 days are safe to give in combination with HIV medicines. What about monkeypox? One thing I'd like to say about monkeypox is, in the United States, a very high percentage of people in the recent outbreak who have monkeypox also have HIV. And it's somewhere on the order of 40 to 50%. So it's a really high percentage. If you are seeing a patient who you think has monkeypox, not only should you test them for monkeypox, but if they've not been previously tested for HIV, you should absolutely test that person for HIV, as well as other sexually transmitted infections. We know just because you have monkeypox doesn't mean you can't have another sexually transmitted infection. So you got to test for monkeypox, but also HIV and other STIs. Why is that important? In people who have poorly controlled HIV or low CD4 count, we have seen some hospitalizations and even deaths due to monkeypox. And the CDC recently put out in their MMWR a case series of people with advanced HIV who essentially died of monkeypox or had very, very severe disease. So you don't want to miss the opportunity to diagnose HIV and treat it if you can. One other question that we just don't know the answer to is, does the drug tecovirimat, people sometimes call it TPOX, does tecovirimat work for monkeypox? And there is an important study called STOMP, which is going on around the country to answer this question once and for all. And you can have people with or without HIV in the STOMP trial.
I want to spend some time talking about pre-exposure prophylaxis, or PrEP. And there is substantial evidence to support the use of antivirals as prevention of HIV. And increasingly, this is something that is being managed in the primary care setting. How effective is PrEP, and who should receive PrEP?
That's a good question. And as you said, this is really important for all of us who care for patients and all of us who do primary care to really be aware of and offer patients. And in the last year, the CDC has really recommended that all sexually active adolescents and adults be at least considered for PrEP. That is, a discussion happen with all sexually active adolescents and adults And also anyone who injects non-prescription drugs, things like opiates or methamphetamine or other prescription drugs. So really, it's everyone in our primary care practice who has a risk factor should be at least offered or discussed the option of PrEP. How effective is it? It is highly effective. I would say PrEP really came to the fore a little over a decade ago. And in people who are consistently taking PrEP, it's almost unheard of for them to acquire HIV. Very, very rarely, there have been some instances of acquisition. So we do have to monitor our patients. We typically monitor every 2 to 3 months, depending on what PrEP option they're on. Nothing is 100%, but it's very close to 100%. What are the options for PrEP? This too has changed, again, reflecting, I think, the dynamism of this field. The first PrEP option that came to the fore is a drug called tenofovir with FTC. And so that was given and is given once a day, one pill once a day. So daily oral PrEP is one option. And I would say most of my patients are on daily oral PrEP. They take one pill once a day and it prevents them from acquiring HIV. The guidelines that we just published also outline an option for what's called on-demand PrEP. What that means is someone who knows or can predict when they're going to be sexually active, they can take PrEP 2 to 24 hours before sexual activity and then the next day and the day after. It's sometimes called 2-1-1 because you take two pills before sex, one pill the day after, one pill 2 days after. And then what's most recently been improved, and this is, I think, opening up options, is we touched on injectable treatment, that is every two-month treatment. There is now, just in 2022, a recently improved injectable PrEP, and that's a drug called cabotegravir. It's given every 2 months, and it really opens up our options. We can range from daily oral PrEP to on-demand PrEP to every two-month PrEP. One thing I do want to say here, though, is PrEP is underutilized in the United States. I read recently, and I was at a meeting that we were both at called ID Week, and at ID Week, they made the comment that in the United States, 20% of new HIV diagnoses are among women, but only 8% of PrEP users are women. And so we are underutilizing PrEP. And I think these are really important things in terms of equity to make sure that we offer PrEP, a highly effective preventive, to all patients.
As we've discussed, there's been a lot of progress made in terms of antiretrovirals. What do you see as the remaining major gaps in terms of therapy?
So there are a couple of gaps, I would say. One is actually not even in therapy. It's just in recognizing HIV. And what I mean by that is, even today, there is a substantial proportion of people in the United States who have HIV who've not been tested and don't know that they have HIV. And that's really important because if they don't know they have HIV, they can't take precautions to prevent transmission. So that has a public health impact. But I also want to say it has an individual impact. Remember how we started by saying that earlier you treat, the better? That's what the START study showed us. In the United States, 20% of people with HIV are diagnosed with a CD4 count of less than 200. That's way too late. You want to be diagnosing them when they have a close to normal CD4 count, because the lower the CD4 count when you start, the more inflammation there is. There's some effects on the immune system. And so one of the major gaps is just earlier diagnosis and earlier treatment. We talked about some of the side effects. I would say we still need some progress in terms of reducing the excessive weight gain that can be linked to certain ARVs. We need some more progress on the metabolic complications. We need to understand how aging and people with HIV kind of interact and what is the best regimen for our older patients with HIV. And then the three last things I want to highlight. One is we need new drugs for multi-drug resistant HIV. And one drug I want to alert people to, which would be one of the first new classes of drugs for HIV, is for multi-drug resistant HIV, and it's a so-called capsid inhibitor. All our other drugs work on other parts of the virus. A drug called lenacapavir was recently approved in Europe. And we talk about it in our guidelines, it might be approved in the United States, and that would give us another option for multi-drug-resistant HIV. There are not that many people with multi-drug-resistant HIV, but for those who have it, it's really, really important to have options. The last two things I want to say in terms of major gaps, we talked about long-acting options. One thing I would love to see is, could we develop long-acting options that can be given not every 2 months, but every 6 months? Or even every year. I think that would go a long way towards reducing stigma and improve people's quality of life if we could give therapy every 6 months or once a year. And then the last thing, and this is I would invite our readers to really delve into, for the very first time in our guidelines, we have an entire section on management of substance use disorder in people with HIV. I think what we've learned is that we need an integrated, multidisciplinary approach for patients who have both HIV and substance use disorder. And also, we need innovative strategies to promote access, things like mobile clinics, walk-in clinics, use of telehealth. So take a look at that part in particular, because I think it's a really important and particularly vulnerable population.
I want to close our conversation with a general question on health equity and access. And perhaps not intentionally, but a lot of this discussion is focused on high resource settings, including the United States. But of course, HIV is a global pandemic. Today, we have the tools to treat and prevent HIV, but infections have not gone away, as we've discussed. And in some groups, infections are increasing. This notion of getting to zero has been an aspirational goal for years. Raj, as you look forward, what gives you hope that we're going to achieve this goal?
Early in my career, HIV highlighted this issue of the importance of vulnerable populations, disparities in care. It really came full circle when we got to COVID, where those very same vulnerable populations are disproportionately affected by COVID. And that's certainly been the case for HIV. So I think both pandemics have really just highlighted this issue that the only way we can really effectively deal with pandemics is to put equity at the core of what we do. The late, great Paul Farmer made that the mission of his life. And I think he taught us all that you can't just bring access to care and equity in afterwards. It's got to really be there from the beginning. And so what gives me hope, and I guess what I would say about both HIV and COVID, but let's start with HIV, is we have the tools now to really prevent HIV. We talked about PrEP. We have the tools to diagnose HIV, and we have the tools to treat HIV. I think what we need to do now is really deploy those tools, take what we have, sustain our workforce. You can only care for people if you have a workforce that can do it. And I think with those tools, we can, not only in our lifetimes, but in the next decade, really drive down HIV rates in high resource countries like the United States to the point that we end the HIV epidemic. That is not only a worthy goal, but an achievable goal if we just use the tools that we have, keep our eyes on the ball, and provide access to care for those who don't have it.
Dr. Rajesh Gandhi, thank you for joining me today, and thank you for all you do.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
This episode was produced by Shelley Steffens at the JAMA Network. The audio team here also includes Jesse McQuarters, Daniel Murrow, Lisa Harden, Audrey Foreman, and Mary Lynn Furkeluk. To follow this and other JAMA Network podcasts, please visit us online at jamanetworkaudio.com. Thanks for listening.